So I have the privilege of summarizing the information which came from the Global Network and many of the important other contributors in the developing world. And I want to talk about new and hopefully better strategies that are emerging to meet the Millennium Development Goals 4 and 5. And I'm going to try to take a 30,000-foot view so that you have something to take away, as well as to provide a few details about other programs, because I think there are some of the things you really need to know some details about. Now, I have absolutely nothing to disclose. And what do I... Different. Okay, so I have nothing to disclose. And we're going to talk about examples of progress to improve the outcome of women and children and promising interventions. I don't think we'll have time for the Global Health Initiative. So you've seen this information. Richard presented it earlier. And I want to restate it because these are really the fundamental things that you need to focus on, the critical challenges that we have today. He mentioned that neonatal deaths have decreased from 4.6 to 3.3 million, but it took us 30 years. And five large countries still account for more than 50% of the neonatal deaths. As several people mentioned, Indian neonates represent 25% of the total neonatal deaths, almost a million babies annually. And as others mentioned, neonatal deaths are increasingly important because as the under five mortality comes down, they represent a larger proportion. So we really do need to focus on it. And in fact, if you look at the data, they're only going down by 1.7% a year compared to under five deaths, which are going down by 2.2% a year. And even maternal deaths that we've been so worried about, they're going down by 2.3% a year. So we clearly have to focus on neonates, and we have to focus on Africa. Neonatal deaths in Africa are going down by only 1.1% a year, and it'll be 150 years before an African newborn has the same chance to survive as a U.S. newborn. So it's really at a critical point in Africa. As Wally mentioned, the three causes of death are the same. They're one-third asphyxia, one-third prematurity, and one-third severe sepsis. But the important thing is that about 70% of these babies could be, we estimate, because this is a guesstimate, but we think about 70% of these babies could be saved without NICUs, which is a very different level of complexity. So why are neonates so hard to save? Well, certainly it's because they're in very remote locations and their birth attendants aren't as skilled as we would like them to be. But this map of Mozambique, I was stunned by because it illustrates the underlying reason, which I consider the lack of collaboration. There are just too many poorly coordinated and competitive programs. So duplication and gaps and chaos are really inevitable. So despite this patchwork of programs, I don't want you to go away discouraged today because important progress really has been made. We've achieved some new sense of reality on the ground. You don't hear people saying anymore, well, we know what to do, we just need to do it, right? We know how hard it is to just do it. And so instead we're talking about how can we do it best? How can we organize collaboration, and how can we identify important barriers, and what do we need to prioritize as we're doing this, and what exactly do we need to do to increase demand in populations that have never had these services, and how do we measure impact? This is absolutely critical if we're going to convince the world and countries to spend their money on their women and children. And finally, how do we ensure sustainability? This is the final challenge, as well as increasing political will. And let's talk about that, and I hope I'm trying to hurry so that we have time in the final session to spend some time on this. So I think the other progress we've made is we've really identified six things that I think are pivotal. And people are, there's pretty much of a consensus on this, that we need to create a supportive environment for mothers and children. We need to develop and prevent strategies that represent a continuum of care. We need to use packages of essential services and strengthen them up to strengthen the healthcare system and the community. We need to leverage resources, and that's often difficult to do without the collaboration I talked about. We need to expand data research and evidence base, and we'll talk a little bit more about that because we haven't had time to talk much about that. We need to make maternal, newborn, and child survival and accountability an absolutely global imperative. That accountability we rarely talk about as much as we should. So these are the things, this is my slide 8, which has my best thoughts about new strategies. I think we need to focus on capacity building, to focus on collaboration, to build more public-private partnerships, to use intervention packages to ensure that a continuum of care is there, to mobilize communities, to absolutely stress registries of all births and deaths, and we'll talk about why that's so important in a minute, to use appropriate new technology, not to just be enchanted with any technology. CPAP is much better than a ventilator. Room air to bag a baby with it in the delivery room is much better than oxygen. You know, you have to use the most appropriate technology for the setting. And finally, look at an emphasis on monitoring and evaluation. And this might be, in fact, the most important of all these things. So this is a slide from Zambia and our project there to teach resuscitation skills. And I think it represents the new thought in capacity building. Instead of counting how many people we've trained, we're actually looking, I don't know if we have a pointer here, but we're actually looking at, up to date. Okay, so we're looking at not only the initial steps of resuscitation, but also ventilation and chest compression. So this is a pretty advanced one. And you'll see that even though these were skilled birth attendants, their performance, their skills were not very good at outset. 67% did quite well in initial steps, but they couldn't ventilate well, and they really didn't know how to do chest compressions, which won't be necessary in most settings. They all improved consistently after training, and when we went back, we were happy to see at 6 months that 85 to 79% had retained their skills. However, we still emphasize that you have to repeat and test at 4 to 6 months. And this is true in pediatrics in the United States as well. So capacity building should be based on skills and repeated skills evaluation. So this is the first slide on collaboration. And I think it's really important to Wally actually showed this in his last one. This is called the global Golden Minute, and this is a teaching program for birth attendants to be used wherever a baby is born, and it has a very simple message: you have 1 minute to establish respiration in a newborn, and if they are not doing it spontaneously, you have to establish it with a bag and mask. Now, 1 minute doesn't sound very long. But I usually have people hold their breath for 1 minute at this point, and very few people, except Olympic swimmers, can do that. So it is a long time for the baby, and it's a very short time for the provider. So whether the baby cries at birth, which is right here, and is green and goes sailing to his mom, or whether the baby is a bit depressed and needs some stimulation, or whether the baby on the far side, and we've got that cut off the slide, actually is very depressed. He's over here, and he will need the bagging to get his ventilation established by 1 minute. So this program has actually dramatically increased the materials available. Okay, dramatically improved the materials available. This is, you can see, a brand new baby that's been developed that is very inexpensive, $15, and a brand new bag and mask, which in fact the newest one is vertical online and has a reinforced cuff on the mask so that you can get an excellent seal. So this is really a dramatic improvement in the materials, but it also represents a commitment by Lerdal, because they are providing this at cost to Millennium Development Countries 4 and 5. So this is unprecedented. And if you see at the very bottom, I don't know if you can read this very well, but this is a collaboration between the five basic partners that signed on to this. The American Academy of Pediatrics, a professional pediatric group. Lerdal, a public-private partnership, a company that started out funding this and then finally made a foundation committed to this. To USAID, which is the U.S. government's major funding agency for development overseas, NIH, which is I work for and funds the Global Network, which is the primary funding agency, and finally Save the Children, which is a major NGO. So this brings collaboration to a whole new effort and represents a rollout globally. The first one that is going to be not only rolled out globally, but assessed, monitored, and assessed from the outset. So you will look at this and compare this to the map of Mozambique. You can see that up to 30 countries are going to be doing this rollout, and we have an excellent website which has a new implementation guide for the developing world. It has a great website. It has an organized prospective rollout plan. Each country that it's being rolled out in is committed to this and participating in the rollout. Each one has an evaluation plan, which we'll talk about in a minute, and each one has funding. So this is collaboration to a whole new level, as I mentioned before. There are also other kinds of public-private partnerships.
That should work.
Oh, here we go. So just takes persistence. Someone mentioned this before. There are other kinds of public-private partnerships, and Venture Strategies, I think Shiva mentioned this, is a wonderful company that has helped register misoprostol in about 19 countries now, and whose truck is here is shown in one of our clinics in Zambia, in a public health clinic. I was so delighted to see it. And another sign of progress, which I mentioned before, was that packages of interventions are being designed, because we know single interventions don't work. Not surprising when you think of Mozambique and you think of the rural villages that we're trying to accomplish these monumental tasks at. This is Robert Goldenberg, who is actually discussing the Global Network's Emergency OB and Neonatal Care trial. It's three-part inventions. Sounds like Chopin, but it isn't. It's upgrading facility services with staff training and resuscitation and C-sections and death audits and that kind of thing. It's teaching communities to recognize babies and moms that are in trouble and to stabilize and transfer them. And finally, critical is the community mobilization to help communities themselves identify and choose and then implement strategies to improve the outcome of women and children. And another pearl, I told you I was going to give a few more details, and this is the importance of community involvement. Thank you. Community involvement is absolutely critical to providing appropriate interventions and increasing demand and making these interventions sustainable. And here you see community mobilization at work. These are people standing around pictures of baby problems and mom problems. And what has happened is one of the community members who's back here, one of several, have actually described the problems to the community who's been listening. And then the community votes by coming up and putting stones on the things that are most important. And they're things like the baby's too small, the baby isn't eating, there are too many babies, maternal hemorrhage. So at the end of the day, you get the community actually standing up and voting on the problems that they think are very important. And then later they finally work out strategies to solve these problems for the things that are chosen. So you can see that it really, publicly, they're making a commitment, and it does make a difference to sustainability. So the problems that are, or the strategies that are chosen are individualistic and quite pragmatic. This comes from our Pakistan site, and it's a newspaper article that describes one of the 1,800 villages that were in Emonk in Pakistan. And they solved the problem of maternal hemorrhage when a young mother almost died of postpartum hemorrhage with twins, and they had no blood, and none was available. So the community typed all the women and the men in the village, and now whenever a woman has a problem pregnancy, she goes with the woman for the delivery. So sometimes our strategies are way too highfalutin. There are really things that work on the ground, and if we trust our communities to identify them, they are sustainable. One of the most important changes is our recognition of the critical need for birth and death registries, which was mentioned by some of my colleagues. The advantage is unlike the household survey, they provide real data, not modeled data, that is accurate and timely, is more accurate than the government data, and it's population-based. It allows communities and providers and funding agencies and countries to track trends over time. So they can identify successful strategies and interventions, and they can identify barriers to implementation, and they can identify risk factors. And so this is an example of a registry in the global network, and you see that we have more than 100 clusters of at least 500 deliveries a year. Shivas is much, much bigger, as you will see on Belgaum in India. But we try to register all women by the second trimester and track them monthly with monthly reports. And so you can see that we have over 200,000 women in this registry now. So registries are wonderful because they tell you things like where the woman actually delivered and who delivered the woman. And what were the complications, and most of all, outcome. Did the baby die? Did the mom die? You know, have a lot of data. So this is more challenging than it seems. In the U.S., we didn't have universal birth registries till the 80s, but it's absolutely critical that we emphasize those today. Now, appropriate technology is going to make this a lot easier to collect registry data. The global network had trouble registering these pregnancies in the second trimester and getting exact birth weights in rural Kenya until we started using cell phones, and you can see what a difference it made.
Wow.
We also had similar experiences in Nagpur, India, where we were trying to get our data faster, and it really made a huge difference. So going back finally to the really big important question of collaboration and appropriate technologies, we think this is going to be very, very attractive, not only to this big project here, which is the Grand Challenges, and I can't read it from here, but you'll see that it was Norway, Gates,
Canada,
oh, I can't hear too, sorry, Canada,
HRTF, World Bank Development Marketplace.
Yeah, World Bank Market Developing Place, USAID, and Gates. So it was five partners that went together for a huge competition. And did I mention Norway?
Yes.
Norway is very important. Yeah. Okay, and USAID. So they went together for a big competition on new technologies, and the finalists came to D.C., and 19 of them got seed grants. And three got huge transition grants, Grameen, Columbia University, and John Snow. I would like to describe what they got them for, but I'm not going to because we're running out of time. And I want to show you just a couple of other places. This is the website for Saving Lives at Birth, which is the Grand Challenges. And WHO has recently published a compendium for new and actually implemented technologies, which you should look for on their website. It's a very nice publication. And finally, I'm going to skip over that. Finally, evaluation, which I said I thought was the most important thing, most important innovation. We're not talking about how many trained. We're talking about needs assessment, program model and theory assessment, process evaluation, impact evaluation, and as Wally mentioned, cost effectiveness analysis, which is an all new world. USAID is using this as their new framework for monitoring and evaluation, and you'll notice they ask to specify inputs, process, outputs, outcomes, and impacts. And this will be used for helping babies breathe. And other governments are also taking this up, most notably Norway. And finally, I did want to mention that the Global Network is going to be looking at lives saved with this. So everybody is going to do process evaluation, and we are going to do impact evaluation with lives saved using the registry. So finally, I want to mention a new project called Mandate and tempt you with this, pique your interest. Mandate is funded by the Gates Foundation, and it has been performed by our data center, our RTI data center. And it is a brand new compendium of technologies that will assess and analytical tools which will prioritize efforts and assess what we think will be most effective before they're implemented. So the tool will ultimately include an interactive cause of death tree, a technology assessment, and a predictive model. So look for this to be forthcoming. It was presented to Bill and Melinda Gates at the end of 2 weeks ago, and it has 2 more years of funding. So it should be very exciting. And finally, both NIH and WHO are now putting a detailed electronic program map on their website. So that will complement clinicaltrials.gov and other registries so that all of us really know what's going on in the world and know who we can collaborate with. If I had time, I will go back to slide 8 so that we can look at the list in case some of you missed it. Because that's what I want to leave with you. Okay, thank you very much.
I know the hour is late, and we had certainly heard some wonderful presentations. Let's take a few questions until they toss us out. Yes?
I had a question for Deborah. I wondered if you, apart from fixing the 1,000 ml as the, cut point for established non-inferiority, did you look at the mean blood loss in the two groups and the mean blood loss in the upper quartile and the upper 50%? Because in these populations, which quite often are highly anemic, every incremental increase in blood loss is very important.
And I'm going to turn this over to one of the PIs, either Richard or Shiva.
The short answer is yes, we did. I think we have to wait until the paper is published. It's pre-publication data, and so I think we pushed that umbrella a little bit already to share the big data. But the answer is all of those variables were looked at. And we did it as well with our own study in use of misoprostol.
Are the results encouraging for the clinical
outcome?
Yes.
There you go. That's what you wanted to know.
It's an excellent question. Any other questions from the group? Yes.
Yeah, other questions, Deborah. Could the push being apparently to move toward oxytocin, maybe community-based distribution of oxytocin, you talk to two potential problems. One is the storage of oxytocin in the community or low resource settings. And the second is the potential for misuse in the communities to augment or reduce.
You hit on a couple of very good questions. First of all, I would say one of the issues, and I think maybe with the new PPH guidelines we will start to address it, is that WHO hasn't got its head around community-based misoprostol. So I do think there's an awful lot going on out there. There's a lot of support for that because, in fact, we know oxytocin ultimately, while it's much more stable than ergometrine and more stable than people think, it can stay out. In fact, 10 years ago in the U.S., it wasn't refrigerated. It was kept at room temperature. But moving it to communities in 90-degree, 100-degree, 110-degree is a whole different kettle of fish. I think we've got oxytocin in Unigex now being produced in Argentina. So that's it has basically a vaccine biomonitor on it, so you'll know if it's good or not. There's a lot of things going on in the world now. I was just at a meeting where it was WHO's EPI program suggesting that we need to put vaccine biomonitors on oxytocin so we would know. So, again, I think it's not just can we get oxytocin there, but where, the role of misoprostol. And the bottom line is, can we ensure that women who choose, or even if they just can't get and choose to deliver it home, that we can ensure they get uterine tonics. Now, your second question was?
Was the potential for misuse of
oxytocin. Oh, you're hitting a whole another kettle of fish. Go on www.pphprevention.org and look up a really great paper. It was done under Poppy. I initiated it, but Cindy Stanton and Hopkins did a whole bunch of research. There are huge issues out there, particularly Southeast Asia, and, you know, sporadically. But then you've got countries like Ghana who looked at India and said, you've got to be kidding. You're doing what? And it's absolutely not happening. So I think we've got two issues. One, where it's happening, knowing it's happening. And number two, how do we stop that? It's 20 years of this kind of problem. So that's a huge issue in Southeast Asia. But how do we keep it from happening in other countries? And that's probably one of my passions right now.